Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Welcome to The Athletic Support, everybody. My name is Marc-Antoine Godin, alongside Arpin Basu. Well, alongside, not exactly, because I'm in Florida, and Arpin, you're still in Montreal.
I am in Montreal, so we couldn't be less alongside, really, but but we are together through the magic
exactly.
of the internet.
It's an old habit to say that. So we're Friday, March the 6th, and today, well, earlier today, we received the sad news, the passing of former Canadiens legend Henri Richard. It was to a certain extent expected because he's been ill for many years, suffering from Alzheimer's disease, and he had been off the public eye for many years. But it's still sad to hear, sad to see, it's one more legend of the Canadiens after. Gosh, a few years only after Jean Béliveau, it's yet another former Canadiens great that leaves us. It's sad.
Yeah, it's sad. And this is, Henri Richard, I think, is sort of, Jean Béliveau epitomized so many things for the Canadiens, the class and the leadership and everything and just the brand itself. I mean, the Canadiens were Jean Béliveau and Jean Béliveau was the Canadiens in many ways. Henri Richard to me sort of epitomized team. You know, he was this guy who was never the biggest star on his team, or even close to being the biggest star on his team, but just consistently made his teams, so much better and made them championship caliber teams, by just playing his game and being himself and doing what he did and leading in his own sort of quiet way. He made, he sort of fueled, he didn't fuel, he entered the league, on the greatest dynasty in NHL history, won the Stanley Cup his first 5 years in the league, and then sort of just kind of carried, sort of a bridge between Maurice Richard and Jean Béliveau and played in Béliveau's shadow after playing in his brother's shadow to start his career, but was just a truly great team guy. Who that never let that bother him and instead made it drive him to great things and wound up with his name on the Stanley Cup 11 times as a player, which no one is ever going to come close to approaching ever again.
No, exactly. That's why I call him the man with a missing finger, because even though he's got 10 fingers, he would need an 11th one to wear all 11 Stanley Cup rings that he gained over the course of his career. It's more unbeatable than any of Wayne Gretzky's records, I think. It's unimaginable. And he's the man also who had the player who had the most games played with the Montreal Canadiens at 1,259. So that's another big feat, and one of the all-time great captains of this franchise. So, yeah, I remember, you know, I met him when I was a kid, because he was, after his career, he kept in shape by playing a lot of tennis, and he was a member at the same tennis club where my dad was going for a little while, and one day, my dad brought me to his tennis club, and we played together, and just on the next court, there was, here was Henri Richard playing, and so we had a bit of a chat after, you know, after we finished playing in that little lounge there, and he, that was one of his passions after hockey, to play tennis. But he always seemed to me like, instead of necessarily being that bigger than nature persona, like Jean Béliveau, more like the tenacious, hard worker, always on the job, you know? So he had the serious look that his brother also had. And it's, at least that's the way I perceived him, you know, over the course of my adulthood, as we interacted with him on a few occasions before he got ill, but he's, there was always that seriousness, that I wouldn't say nobility, but that, in French we would say, prestance, you know, about him.
Right. So, presence.
Yeah.
There's a presence exactly. About him. And, yeah. And so it's, yeah, I agree. And I think every player from that era, had that same presence. It was just, in his case, I always saw Henri Richard, you know, like Jean Béliveau was a guy who, you know, as a player, if you were a current player on the Montreal Canadiens, you could look to Jean Béliveau and say, wow, that is the bar that's been set. Which is an impossibly high bar to reach for any mm-hmm. player. You know, Béliveau being just one of the dominant players of his era, made it very difficult for a player to imagine being as great as he was. Whereas Henri Richard was not given anything. You know, he was not given physical attributes that would lead him to reach the NHL. In fact, he was so small as a kid. When teachers asked him what he wanted to do, he said he'd be a plumber instead of admitting that he wanted to play for the Montreal Canadiens, because, you know, he was so small that he feared he'd be laughed at. But he did it, and everything he accomplished in his career was through force of will and strength, both mental and physical, and just overcoming odds. And it's, if you wanted to choose someone to serve as an inspiration for reaching the NHL and thriving in the NHL, I would probably choose Henri Richard over Jean Béliveau. Jean Béliveau, who made the most of his tremendous gifts, God-given gifts that he received, and he made the most of it, no doubt about it. Henri Richard didn't get those gifts, and he still made the most of it because he wanted to that badly, and he was just you know, had the same passion as his brother, and wound up having a longer career than his brother, wound up winning more Stanley Cups than his brother. Didn't score as many goals, didn't get as many awards, for sure. He barely got any individual awards over the course of his playing career, but just willed himself to greatness, and just showed the power that can have when you couple that with talent. The will is what really allows you to overcome obstacles. And so if I were choosing a former Canadiens legend to point to, as a young player coming in, I would have a tendency to point to Henri Richard and say, look at what he made of himself, in spite of all the obstacles that were placed in his way.
I listened to you talking about him, and it reminds me a little bit of Brendan Gallagher, and it makes me think that it's really unfortunate that he's been sick for so long, because the current Canadiens players have never been able to really interact with him. Whereas the guys that were there like only 8-9 years ago, they well knew Jean Béliveau, because he was around the team until pretty much the very end. So there is a, right now there's sort of a disconnect between the current group of players and that legacy from the olden days, which was bound to happen at some point. Everybody gets old, but the fact that he was not able to transmit some of his wit, some of its presence to the actual group is a a little bit sad. And now you look at the former greats that are left, and you go down the list, and that list is not very long, and it's Guy Lafleur at this point who's still carrying the torch. So
yeah, I mean, you know, out of the players from those 70s teams, yeah, I mean, there's definitely, it's obviously several others, but I mean, as far as the great ones, right. He's it. But it actually, you know, you mentioned Brendan Gallagher several years ago when I was at NHL.com. I did a story on the unique pressure of playing for the Montreal Canadiens, how it's different than every other team and why it's different. And there were lots of sort of different, I guess, theories that I explored in that story. But one of them was this inherent, this constant presence of past greatness that is always around the team. Henri Richard being a part of that, you know, we would routinely see him walking into the alumni lounge between periods until his condition didn't allow him to do so. But he took such enormous pride in being a former Canadian and in the Canadians themselves. And so I spoke to Brian Gionta about that because I did this thing on I split it into three parts on what it means to coach and be the captain and be the goalie for the Canadiens, the three sort of most highly pressurized positions on the team. And Gionta, that was the one thing he met, when I asked him, like, what is it that made the pressure in Montreal unique from other places? And that was the first thing he pointed to was the winning. He was like, there's this history of winning. And even though no one comes up to you and tells you that this is what you have to live up to, you can't avoid it. And, you know, we've been in the Canadiens dressing room. You see all the faces looking down at you of all the Hall of Famers who have worn the Canadiens uniform. You have the rosters of all the great teams, all the great Canadian teams of the past on the walls. You every day when they go play at the Bell Center, they walk by a display with 24 Stanley Cup replicas, just sitting there in a window illuminated. It's this constant reminder, the Canadiens take such pride in their past, and they should, because, you know, they're by far
it's their DNA.
It's their DNA, and it should be. They should take pride in that. They have 24 Stanley Cups in franchise history. The Leafs are next at 13. I mean, this is an enormous run of dominance that they had. But the current team can never live up to that, can never even hope to live up to that, and have not come close since 1993. And so, but it was this notion from Gionta's, on Gionta's part, that seeing these guys around just reminds you of who you're playing for. So you're not only playing for yourself, you're not only playing for your organization or team, you're also playing for them. And it adds just this extra layer of pressure when you play for the Canadiens. But he also kind of described it as a privilege as well, that they got to interact with these guys and ask them questions and hear their stories and understand what it meant to be part of those great Canadiens teams and allowed them to sort of aspire to do something that comes anywhere close to what they accomplished.
Yeah. And so it was all about the winning, and Henri Richard, well, all he did was win. That's all he did. You know, he was the epitome of a winner. So, the Canadiens right now, this season, are not winning nearly as much. Another loss last night, in Tampa Bay. But instead of analyzing the ins and outs of the daily performances, I wanted to, switch gears here and take you to Boca Raton, where, well, only a few miles up north from where I am currently, where the GM meeting was held earlier this week. And we learned, among many other things during those meetings, is that the salary cap will go up next season, and the range that was suggested is quite wide. It goes from anywhere between 84 and a little bit over $88 million for next year. Those are surprising numbers. The higher limit seems outrageous to me, because I really can't see, apart from the 5% escalator that the Players Association could request, and I don't think they will, I don't see the that new extra revenue that could suddenly justify such a boom. But the fans will be happy to hear that every team has got more money to spend, which means that whoever you cheer for, any team can come out of a rough patch salary-wise, thanks to the salary cap. But it remains to be seen if it's going to be at what end of the spectrum this is going to be. I suspect that it's going to be more on a much more conservative end of the spectrum than the outrageous 88 million that they've been forecasting.
Yeah, well, our James Myrtle has a piece out on The Athletic right now, talking about how the salary cap's unlikely to rise all that much next season, let alone to the low end of that spectrum of $84 million. He, you know, crunches a bunch of revenue numbers and HR numbers and the cap and escrow and everything coming out and sort of does not see a way, that it could hit that figure. It seems unlikely to him that to be the case. However, I find it interesting that they released, those are the numbers the NHL chose to release. I think the shockingly high number is part of a strategy on the NHL's part. Yeah. I'm not quite sure what it is, but in any case, it does impact the Canadians in a certain way, even if it doesn't quite hit 84, let's say it hits 83.5, but if it's higher than, if the increase is higher than the percentages we've seen in the past few years, it actually hurts the Canadians a little bit, and it takes away one of their primary advantages when it comes to salary cap.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you know, when I said that every team would be happy to have more money to work with, well, the teams that are tight against the cap right now will finally get out of a jam because of that, if they've got more money to work with, which is not the case of the Canadians, because they've cultivated that wiggle room for what, 3 years now. That the pressure that top teams that has been spending to the limit have been experiencing, that pressure that could potentially work to the advantage of the Canadians, as we've seen in the Joel Armia deal with the Winnipeg Jets, that suddenly disappears. And the other thing is, the Canadians will be able to negotiate new deals with Max Domi. They can sign Max Domi tomorrow if they want, but by July 1st, because he's a restricted free agent. But the crop of unrestricted free agents from summer 2021, they'll be eligible to sign new contracts on July 1st. On that day, the whole league will know the exact number of the new salary cap for next season, and if it's raised by any significant margin, well, all those potential UFAs, they will be the ones wanting a bigger piece of the pie. All that newly freed up money will go to these players. So I suspect that only retaining the players that seek new contracts with the Canadians, like the Denos, the Gallaghers, etc. Well, that's where that money is going to go, because the players will say, hey, wait, well, there's more money and that's available to us. It won't be available to the guys that have already signed long-term contracts. It's new money for new contracts. So, I doubt that it's going to be, help the Canadians do any more than just retain the guys that they hope to re-sign.
Well, and on top of that, you know, remember what Mark Bergevin said on the trade deadline, that you know, he cited teams being up against the salary cap as being a factor in June that would facilitate hockey trades. And
yeah,
so if every team becomes less, you know, constrained by the salary cap, perhaps the opportunities for Mark Bergevin to make some impact moves in June lessens to a certain extent. Because not as many teams are desperate to move out salaries, and their own salary cap space becomes less valuable. And I think the argument could be made that, you know, if this comes to pass, if the salary cap does rise by this amount, you could easily argue that Mark Bergevin did not act quick enough to take advantage of the window where you know, where his salary cap space was a weapon. And he did use it to acquire Yoel Armia, a very effective player in Yoel Armia. But you could be argued, because I've never been someone who advocated that Mark Bergevin should be spending to the cap no matter what. Because I don't think anyone wants their general manager to spend money in a stupid or frivolous way. And just throwing money at a guy that you don't particularly want is the definition of doing that. However, there had to have been more occasions where he could have done more things like the Armia trade during the time where his cap space was as valuable as it was. And if the cap is going up this high, then his cap space suddenly decreases in value quite significantly as soon as that cap number comes out.
Exactly. And you look at teams that are tight against the cap right now, a team like, for example, the Dallas Stars, who you could argue could be perceived as potential trade partners with the Canadiens. Well, they don't have all that many guys to re-sign this summer. So all their key guys are signed, for the next couple of years at least. So for them, you know, having more money to deal with, fine, they'll take it. And it just really, releases the extra pressure. I agree with you. Although I remember, to be honest, I think that the first year that the Canadiens had all that money available, I was disappointed that the Canadiens did not spend it. They chose to withhold some money and not spend it on Radulov and or Andrei Markov. That was a whoever comes first basis, and right. Neither of the two ended up coming. So all that money was left on the table, and they were not replaced. And I think that to this day, you could argue that not having Alexander Radulov on this team has been hurting the Canadiens to a certain extent. But since then, the last 2 years, I think that it was savvy management to just avoid spending like crazy for no reason and just keep your bullets for a longer term and for other contracts that eventually would call for that money. And that's we're reaching to that key moment this summer.
Yeah, well, I mean, because the thing is, when you mention that all these teams should be happy, is that, you know, you're assuming that these teams are in the running for free agents in the summertime, and the Canadiens generally aren't one of those teams. And really, this not to make like a clumsy tie-in, but this is one of the things that I always think about when one of the great Canadiens legends passes away, like an Henri Richard, is just how the Canadiens are no longer a destination. They're no longer a place where players strive to play. You know,
it's not a magnet. It's not a magnet at all.
And there's no aura about the team anymore. I mean, there used to be just this championship aura where. And you still hear players say it today. Like, as soon as they play a game in Canadiens uniform, the thrill of putting on that uniform is still something that players mention. But it's not something that will make them necessarily forego another place in order to sign in Montreal. In fact, it's quite the opposite, where oftentimes, even if the Canadiens are in the running, they almost never win those players, oftentimes because all sorts of reasons are cited. But you know, the Canadiens sort of bank on this notion of being the Montreal Canadiens to carry some weight with players, and maybe it does with some, but I think for the vast majority, that weight is no longer there. And it's sort of, you know, you get reminded of that when these greats of the past pass away, and you sort of remember, you know, the legacy that they created and the reputation that they built for this organization. That isn't really there anymore. And that kind of makes it even sadder when these guys pass away, is that, you know, every time one of these great former Canadiens leaves us, I think a little piece of that old reputation of this franchise leaves us as well.
Yeah, and that goes back to not winning a cup since 1993, because you cannot count necessarily on an 84-year-old man to transmit that and cultivate a connection with the actual players forever. I mean, but there had to be other generations after to cultivate that winning environment, that winning spirit. I understand that the league has changed, and there's a whole bunch of new factors that explain why the Canadiens are not you know, could not hope to win as many Stanley Cups as they did before. But still, that long dry spell that lasted over two generations, it breaks the connection a little bit. It's a little bit like, it's like the Expos in baseball. You know, people say, well, the Expos are going to come back and the fans are going to reconnect with their sport, but there's a whole generation that has not lived the Expos and they will have to learn about baseball again. There's been a disruption in how the sport has been transmitted from one generation to another. Well, if you put that on the ice among hockey players, that connection within the Canadians and their alumni is not what it used to be.
No, it's not. And that's, you know, I think that kind of, so, you know, to bring us back to what we're talking about, this whole salary cap situation, is that every time every other team is facilitated in acquiring high-end players, the Canadians are naturally disadvantaged because they're not that location anymore, and they are not, you know, they are not a place where players dream to play. And so, you know, but I still think, you know, if we just switch gears here for a second and just, you know, talk a little bit about the offseason to come. You know, our Pierre LeBrun and Craig Custance talked to Mark Bergevin at the GM's meetings in Boca Raton. Mark Bergevin spoke to, you know, every local media outlet basically that showed up there to try and I guess build some momentum towards this upcoming offseason. And I had, you know, I just ran a mailbag on The Athletic where the vast majority of the questions were looking ahead to what's going to happen in June, what's going to happen in free agency, what's going to happen at the draft, what kind of trades are going to be made, this. And it's just like, it just struck me to what extent this fan base is thirsty, starving for something drastic to happen in a certain way. And I was interested, like, I just wanted to get your thoughts on it, is that it seems to me that in every iteration of a rebuild, whatever you want to call it, but when you're trying to reestablish or refresh the talent on your team with younger talent, every one of those teams has to hit a point where they hit a switch, you know, where they flip a switch and they go from gathering young talent to acquiring other talent to get you over the top and become a contending team.
Yeah.
In your opinion, because I think the Canadians have done the gathering young talent part reasonably well. You know, I think the next couple of years are going to tell us how well they've done in these drafts. But by the looks of it, they've unearthed some interesting prospects in the later rounds and who might turn into pretty good NHL players. But, I mean, the beauty of it is that they have so many of them, their chances of finding some are significantly higher. But is this the moment where Mark Bergevin has to flip that switch? Has it reached that point, independent of his own job security and his own, you know, whatever might happen with him at the end of next season if they don't make the playoffs, but is this the proper time over the arc of a reset, as he calls it, or a rebuild or a refresh? Is this the moment when that switch has to be flipped?
If you put aside the first round pick that they will get at the next draft, I would say yes, because not because the fans are uneasy or they're impatient about the way things are going. It's just that at some point there is a responsibility from management to send a signal to the players in the room that they're not being forgotten or sacrificed on the altar of future. And there has to be a point where the future connects with the present in a coherent way. And so so the general manager has to send the signal to Shea Weber, to Carey Price, and the guys that will be signing new contracts like Gallagher, for example, that we're not just selling hope for the future. Bear with us. This is really happening. This is really coming. So there has to be actions that are taken to attach the future and the present together. So that's why I think that finding ways to add some talent, whether it is prospects that are high-end prospects that are ready for the NHL, or like solid contributors that might not be like star players, but are solid contributors between the age of 20 and 25. I think you have to find ways to bolster this lineup so that it doesn't only rely on the shoulders of Suzuki and Kotkaniemi's development. Otherwise, you'll have to wear a few more years for that to happen. If everything goes right, if those guys end up being the players that they can be, they'll end up carrying the team on their shoulders one day. But it's not going to be necessarily with Carey Price around or with Shea Weber around, at least not in their most, more effective years of their career. No doubt about it. So right now you talk about the bunch of prospects. They have a great crop of prospects, but they remain prospects. It remains to be seen. And you've heard Marc Bergevin tempering expectations a little bit, for example, regarding Cole Caulfield, saying, well, we think he's not ready. He's going to go back to Wisconsin. It's great for his development if that's what they think that he needs to be doing. They don't want to rush him. I'm all for that. But at the same time, it's that there's a hope that those guys that are potential game changers, and there's not many of them in their prospect pool, but Caulfield is one of them. If you push him back 1 year, well, that's one more year with the current group that for the current group for which everything has to go right, performance-wise, health-wise, for them to be somewhat close to a contender or at least a playoff team. So there has to be something that ends up connecting the future and the present at some point.
Yes, I agree, and I think there are a number of factors that make it so that this June is the perfect confluence of all sorts of different things that not only allows Marc Bergevin to act in an aggressive way, but almost forces him to act in an aggressive way. And here I'm going to tell you what I think they are. You tell me if I'm wrong. So for one, Marc Bergevin has all sorts of tools that a general manager generally requires in order to be aggressive heading into the draft. He has, as we mentioned, a number of prospects that were recently drafted. Now, the beauty of prospects that are recently drafted is that teams still like those prospects, even if maybe they've had a bit of a rough time in junior in their draft plus 1 year or what have you. They still have an abstract value to a lot of teams who really wanted to draft that guy that year and just missed out on him. So you can create value in a prospect that's not really tangible. You still don't know if, say, just for example, a Jacob Olofsson. Sorry, Jacob, if you're listening, but I'm just using as an example. A Jacob Olofsson in Sweden, who's taken 56th overall in 2018. Was, you know, the Canadiens' third of three second round draft picks. But, you know, by all accounts that year, I saw many projections that saw him going late first round, early second round. He fell a fair amount, which would suggest that maybe he wasn't all that sought after by teams, but maybe there were teams picking late in the first round who considered him and were really bummed that he had reached, he made it as long as he did, and didn't get a chance to take him in the second round. Anyhow, as an example, Ullonen could be a guy like that as well, and he has a chance to prove what he can do with Laval over the next the next month or so. But these are guys that are still fresh in teams' minds, and they probably have more trade value now, oddly enough, than they would once they reach the NHL, because they're an abstract notion to a lot of teams, and I think a lot of teams get enticed by that abstract notion of the kid that they saw when they were scouting in 2017-18 season in the case of Olofsson or Ullonen. But a lot of guys, you know, you think of Matthias Norlander or what have you, Struble, Jordan Harris. I mean, there's tons of guys who we don't know if we're going to make the NHL. Their trade value might be highest right now, strangely enough.
Well, Ryan Poehling's a great example. Remember Ryan Poehling? We wrote an article at the beginning of last season to the fact that Marc Bergevin had chosen not to trade him to the Buffalo Sabres for he would have been the centerpiece of a package sent to the Sabres in exchange for Ryan O'Reilly. And he said, no, I'm going to hold on to my young players, my best prospects. No way I'm going to trade Ryan Poehling. Well, today you know, you look at it 18 months later, you think, well, Ryan Poehling, the GM talks about him as a potential, you know, more likely a third line center than a second line center. He's in the American League, and all of a sudden, you know, the shine has rubbed off a little bit, has come off a little bit. And today, if you say, well, if he was the centerpiece of a package for Ryan O'Reilly, well, where do I sign? So it all goes back to the value of where the guy was as a projected prospect, in a specific time. So that's, and 18 months after, the reality might not be exactly the same. So that the same goes for all that bunch of prospects that the Canadian have in their pipeline. And you mentioned Jordan Harris, Bergevin, mentioned the other day that there was a chance that he could turn pro. Well, there you go. A guy that, you know, could, he's sort of pumping the tires of one of his prospects, saying this guy could be soon ready for pro hockey. It's interesting.
Yeah, it is. So that's one of the factors, right, is that these guys, you know, some of them will gain value when they enter the NHL. You know, let's not kid ourselves. Like, if Jesse Ylönen becomes comes in as a rookie and makes the Canadiens next year and scores 18 goals as a rookie, then his trade value will obviously increase. But right now, no one knows if that's like, in fact, I think most people would say that's very unlikely, but no one knows how likely that is to ever happen. But, you know, there are probably a bunch of teams out there who think, in his case, you know, we really like his speed. We could use an injection of that speed in our prospect pool. You know, we're going to put a premium on a guy like that. The other factor that Marc Bergevin has going into June is 14 picks in the upcoming draft. That, again, same deal. Those picks take on massive value heading into the draft. Far more value than they have at the trade deadline, clearly, because teams trade them away to get rentals. But when you have 3 second-round picks, 2 third-round picks, and 3 fourth-round picks, you can use those in a trade to boost the value of the people you're trading. Like, for example, like you just mentioned earlier, how they could maybe go out and get a useful player who could contribute, but not a star level player. And it could be argued that Bergevin doesn't really have star level players to offer in a trade. But when you take a player who is a very good player, but maybe not a star, and you add a potential star prospect who's not a star, but is a prospect that might become a star, and then you add a draft pick where you could potentially draft a star, and package all that together to go out and get a star, that's something that you could see happening for some teams. And Marc Bergevin is somewhat uniquely placed in that he has players that he's willing to listen on. Like, let's be honest, every player whose contract is expiring in 2021, and I'm including Phil Danault and I'm including Brendan Gallagher, it would be foolish of Marc Bergevin to not at least listen to what teams are willing to offer to acquire one of those players. And if he adds one of these draft picks, a second round pick in this upcoming draft, one of the deeper drafts in recent memory, plus a prospect from a previous draft that team really loved, who knows what he could get? Like, I don't know if Marc Bergevin has ever had as many weapons to combine into a trade, like in terms of variety of weapons, as he does now, just because of the number of draft picks they've made in the last two drafts and the number of draft picks they have in the upcoming draft. So it seems like the time is it's not only perfect for him, it's never going to be more perfect than it is right now this June, adding to the fact that the draft is actually in Montreal. So for him to do a splash on the draft floor would obviously play a lot bigger in that sense as well.
Yeah, and all those draft picks that they've got, I mean, how many more draft picks do you want? At some point, it's when you get too much, when you get just too many prospects to draft, you won't be able to sign them once you know, their eligibility period ends, whether it's 2 years or 4 years, depending on where they play. But you have tough decisions to make, especially if you've drafted well and you've got guys that interest you that you'd like to have signed. There's only 50 contracts you can have at once on your roster, on your expanded roster, if you will. So carrying too many draft picks, becomes pointless at some point because the Canadians already have so many of those. So it, I think that's where those three second round picks that they've got, it'll be very interesting to see what they do with them. I agree with you wholeheartedly that the moment is ripe and right, to probably move one of their more interesting prospects. And who knows, there is a couple of roster players that might interest, other teams too. So.
Yeah. And just to add to what you just said, I mean, actually, Craig Cousins brought this very point up with Mark Bergevin, and I thought it was a very important question because it's, we've seen it in the past that when the Leafs were loading up on draft picks, at a certain point, at one point, Lou Lamoriello said, you reach a point where you have too many draft picks. You can't use them all. They become a hindrance more than anything else. And Craig asked Mark this in Boca Raton, about having too many picks. And Mark's answer, the answer was actually pretty interesting in the sense that when he said, when you have to sort of, stagger when all these players become, eligible or when the limit on their rights expires, let's say. So, for instance, this summer, the Canadiens will have to make a decision on, Cam Hillis, Alan McShane, Cole Fonstad and Samuel Lud. They're all CHL players, Canadian Hockey League players that were drafted in 2018. If they are not signed to entry level contracts by this summer, by June 1st, they will re-enter the draft. So the Canadiens have to make a decision on those four players. And what Bergevin was saying is that, you have to stagger those with players who are playing in Europe that have a longer shelf life in that sense, and players in college who have until their 4 years of college are up, where the Canadiens have to make a decision. But what I found the most interesting was actually not in the podcast, was Marc Bergevin telling Mathias Brunet of La Presse that of Hillis, McShane, Fonstad, and Hood, only one is likely to be signed.
Yeah.
So already we are seeing, sort of the other side of having tons of draft picks and drafting tons of players is it's not realistic to sign them all. You do have a relatively brief evaluation window, and already the trade value for three of the four guys that they don't sign is nil because you don't have the rights. Like, I mean, the rights are going to expire. So, I mean, if a guy like Alan McShane, for instance, is, let's say he's the guy that they don't, one of the guys that they don't sign. He re-enters the draft. I mean, the window to have sort of monetized Alan McShane has already passed.
Yeah.
It was basically last summer or sometime this year to include him in a trade, with a team that might have thought that he's a pretty intriguing prospect, a pretty productive player, in the Ontario Hockey League. And so these things are going to keep coming up where these draft picks are going to reach a point where the Canadiens have to make a decision on them. And if they decide not to sign them, they will have essentially wasted a pretty minor asset, but I think it's very reflective of where the Canadiens are at in this whole reset thing is the fact that they have these four players that they drafted only 2 years ago and three of them are about to re-enter the draft. We don't know which three, but three of them, if Bergevin is to be believed, is about to re-enter the draft. So he kind of needs to make sure that the trade value or the asset value of these prospects, even though they're not signed, he needs to make sure he takes advantage of that as quickly as possible because there's a short window. It's shorter for CHL players than it is for European or college players, but the window is not that long where these prospects have a certain value. And if Mark Bergevin was smart about it, he would start monetizing some of these because there's no way that anywhere close to even half of these players they've drafted or a third of them will ever make the NHL. It's just not realistic.
So in order not to be confronted to that problem year after year, at least in 2 years from now with the current crop of players that will be drafted in June in Montreal, perhaps that Bergevin could go against the grain, against what he usually thinks, which is he would rather trade down and accumulate picks, and this time around try to trade up. So bundle up many picks in order to climb up and get higher talent, higher quality draft picks, in exchange for quantity. So it's been his motto to operate otherwise so far, but it's probably a good time to revisit that and realign his strategy based on the fact that the number of draft picks, the number of prospects is saturated.
Yeah. And this is what I mean by flipping a switch, is that it's great to build through the draft. I applaud it. It's taken too long for Bergevin to do this. He did not recognize what was coming before it came, and this is somewhat reactionary to what happened over the past few years. But now that they're into like year three of doing it, he can't be reactionary again. He needs to anticipate things, and to me, the moment to anticipate what's on the horizon is right now, with all these players entering their contract years, young players starting to emerge into the professional ranks and will eventually be challenging to make the team over either next year or the year after, is a moment where if you truly want to compete while doing this, then they have to compete right now. Like, this is the moment, because it's A, if not, and I don't think he would do this for self-preservation reasons, but honestly, if the Canadiens don't make the playoffs next year, I can't see Marc Bergevin remaining as general manager or Claude Julien remaining as coach. But besides that, it just seems like the time in the normal arc of building a winning team, when a team gets aggressive and starts to get creative with the assets that they have, and Montreal has a considerable number of assets that they could trade away, starts to get creative with those assets, to flip their team from a resetting team to an actual contending winning team. And it seems to me that the next 3.5 months are going to be really telling as far as what the Canadiens are going to become, in the next couple of years.
Yeah. So, and for the record, just regarding those four prospects that need to be signed, you named them earlier. My money is on Cam Hillis to be the one that's going to end up being signed by the Canadiens. So we shall see.
Well, mine too. I mean, he's the highest of the four picks and has been the most productive of the four players. So I'll also put my money on him, because seems like sort of a natural fit as far as, and he's earned it. He's had a great season. He had a nightmare season last year, marred by injuries, one after the other after the other, and has bounced back really nicely on a rebuilding Guelph team, and has really been a leader for them. So yeah, I would agree that my money's on him as well.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, we made it without talking about the latest losses of this team, but at this point, the record of the Canadiens is a moot point. It's just trying to determine where their draft pick is going to be, their draft order, their draft ranking. But I'll tell you what, last night in Tampa, they gave it a good shot, especially in the second and third period, but they were overmatched and they knew it before puck drop. And, it's a bit.
What are you talking about? It's a big 4-point game in Florida coming up. Are you kidding me? They're
right,
3 points
right
behind them.
Yes, exactly.
Big four-point game.
Right. For which spot? That's the, you know, for which spot? That's the question.
For being third behind the last wildcard spot. So.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, that elusive spot. All right, everybody. Well, thank you so much for listening to our podcast today. We hope that you enjoyed it. We invite our subscribers of The Athletic to join us on Monday. And for those who have not yet joined The Athletic as subscribers, obviously we invite you to do so. And you can join The Athletic, subscribe to our amazing website and app with 40% off of your first year of subscription by going to theathletic.com/athletic support. So it's theathletic.com/athletic support. So for the listeners of this podcast, it would give you 40% off of your first year of your subscription. So don't hesitate to jump on the offer.
Thanks, Marc-Antoine. Enjoy the rest of your time in Florida. And I will see you on Monday when subscribers to The Athletic will be hearing our shortened version of The Athletic Support podcast, dealing with everything touching the Montreal Canadiens.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.